better put him in the Heisman.
Got that award right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light Seltzer, for those anytime easy drinking occasions.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team that's going to bring back a College World Series title. The Bomb Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast.
Jenkins, you like to watch this occasionally. I know it's not WWE, but occasionally like to watch this. What have you thought about? I know you haven't watched a ton, but what have you thought about this so far? Just the layout.
It's something. I mean, at least
there you go.
I give them credit for just moving forward.
Yep, I'm with you.
Sports like that, and I know there. I mean, there's a big difference between like WWE and UFC, but sports like that were. A lot of it is entertainment. I mean, like Conor McGregor, yes, he's a heck of a fighter. But everybody knows him just for his antics and how he talks and just how he portrays himself. And that plays into the fans aspect of it. So sports like that, you need the fans there. But I give them props just for trying to at least bring normalcy, at least to the viewers at home, because I'll probably never be able to go to a UFC pay-per-view. But I give them props for doing it. It's weird. Wrestling's especially weird with no fans, just because it's all based off the fans' reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But I give them props for doing it. That's my take on it.
Here's what I give them props for: being willing to be first.
That too,
because right now that's what everybody else in sports is banking on: is UFC, Major League Baseball, NASCAR, somebody organizing a professional sporting event and it not being a disaster. That everyone doesn't get sick within 2 days.
And I believe they've done two or three, I'll just say pay-per-views. I mean, one of them was given away free on ESPN this past weekend. But as far as I know, they've went off without a hitch.
They had one fighter and his corner test positive, immediately removed from the card. How they're going about the testing. We need, golf, which is going to crank up here very soon. NASCAR, which started this weekend without fans. We need these events, and those are far less personal challenges with the social distancing than basketball, certainly football, some of the other sports. I'm wondering when tennis could return, because there's a lot of social distancing in tennis. I'm just thinking about sports that could more easily return. If those type of sports, guys, can't return with minimal to no problems, then we'll never get to football. We've got to also move past the idea that you got to have a cure. That's a different conversation. But we've got to be able to realize that there are managed risk and they're managed well. And that if NASCAR and golf and perhaps tennis at some point and other sports can figure out a business model. It's not just the challenge of hosting the events, because baseball doesn't have a ton of personal contact more than some of these other sports. How do you make the business side of it work? One thing to be able to do it and do the testing and keep everybody that's involved safe. How do you pay for it? That's the other thing.
Well, I know I've mentioned on Halftime too. I mean, there's a big difference between say UFC and baseball, where it's not full-fledged contact. But if you're wanting football back, UFC's a good start, because, I mean, that's as physical as it gets.
That's as close a quarters as your. It's more close quarters than football.
Granted.
You have no protective gear on like you do in football. And particularly if they're grappling,
you're all over them. And then, particularly with UFC, if they get busted open, they're bleeding. I mean, that's how you spread stuff.
Right.
If they can do that and not spread it, that's great news for football fans if you want it back. The only difference being football is going to have three times as many people there with coaching staff. But you're only going to have 22 players tackling each other at a time on the field.
I think the college football world and the NFL side of things are just apprehensive at this point, because you want, whether it's golf, whether it's the UFC, we're talking about whoever, to have success doing and going about things they're doing, because if you don't have success in those sports, you're not going to have success on this side of the things at football. That's why they're trying to come up with as many precautionary measures as possible to get ready for the season. There's all these different ideas that are being thrown out there, just because you want to have a number of different areas, a number of different routes that you can take so this actually works. Because again, we talked about this last week, over 450,000 jobs are direct from sports. So anytime someone tells you, I know everyone listening right now is a sports fan. Anytime someone tells you that sports don't have an impact on the economy, read them off the stat that over 450 jobs are just directly impacted from sports. That means the ones that directly work there in the organizations, in the colleges or whatever. That doesn't even include the indirect money that you think about all the businesses involved with sports are. So the college football and the NFL, college football season and the NFL season are the biggest money makers in the sports industry, particularly in the United States. That being said, you have to make sure this goes right because it will cripple the economy if we do not have a college football season and an NFL season. And that's why it's very important that we go about this. And again, Tommy and I are not, or Jenkins are not in charge of this, but the ones that are in charge, they have really smart people around them and they come up with a variety of different things to make sure this goes right.
Yeah, and the good thing is the NFL and the college football get to sit back and watch.
Yes.
You know, they're not in the season. The NBA, Major League Baseball, they need to figure out on the quick, you know, immediately, because their season is going down the drain and these players aren't being paid. The owners are faced with billions of dollars collectively in losses in both sports. They're trying to figure out not just how to safely do it, but how to, at this point, maybe even minimize losses,
yeah,
much less worry about gains. So, you know, I find it amazing, and I know we may get to some of this with some of the Major League Baseball players talking about they've already taken pay cuts, they're not taking any more, and there's a big negotiation going on. It's not just how do we test everybody, how do we safely follow CDC guidelines and provide all of these measures. It's also how do you, I mean, no one's signing up as an owner to lose more money. And if reopening forces you into losing more money, that's a pain that most with owners aren't going to take on for very long.
But I understand their side of things. They already were already taking a pay cut, being prorated and stuff. And there's a constant bickering between the owners and the players. And you obviously are more in the owner type of things. I'm more in a player type role, so I can understand the argument. Like you don't want to give. You feel like the owners already have all the power already when you're going through these negotiations. As you heard talking about in Golic and Wingo this morning, now you're at a sense where it's like you feel like they're trying to leverage, regardless if it's true or not. That's just what you're faced with. You're always with the idea as a player that you're not getting paid adequately to a certain point to what you could be made. Well, that's just the perspective that you face.
In baseball, they're guaranteed the money. They're guaranteed the kind, mm-hmm. unless we have a situation like what we're living through now and there's no games. But the owners have come back and offered, what, a 50-50 revenue split?
Yeah,
is what
they want to do.
How much more fair and equitable do you want to get? I mean,
it's not
you
near
can't
what their salaries were going to be about.
But there's not near the games, and there's no fans, when the major revenue stream, because it's not TV in Major League Baseball, mm-hmm. it's tickets in the ballpark, tickets sold, park. I mean, when you take that part of the equation out, there's got to just be some you got to be reasonable about this, both sides. And, you know, the owners are just trying to figure out, I think, just how to play games and not get their head knocked off.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation for all involved. So,
I mean, at the end of the day, they're being paid a lot of money to play a game they love. Wouldn't we all be so fortunate? Wouldn't we all love to be
well,
so
that's,
fortunate?
I mean, if you're going to get into that argument's just
well,
like,
I mean,
come on, Tommy.
My God, you still need your full $30 million or whatever to go out here and play some baseball?
They're getting paid for a reason. I mean, Tommy,
I understand. I'm not saying let's pay a minimum
wage. Don't get this love for the game argument. Your arguments were good until you
saying,
got in that love for the game.
If 50-50 doesn't work, then I don't know if baseball, if the players reject that, I don't think they return this year. Well, yeah. And then what do the players get?
Yeah.
Zilch.
Zilch.
Well, you have some,
I'm just saying it's a slippery slope. The players are walking here, too.
But who, let me ask you this. Who would be hurt more, the players or the owners?
I think the owners may be hurt just as badly if they even open at all, because they're looking at losses. I think either way, they're just trying to minimize losses.
No, I'm saying, okay, so if the season didn't go accordingly, we don't have the facts and figures in front of us, but who would be hurt more, you think, the players or the owners?
Individually?
Collectively.
Owners, I would say.
Well, I think every situation's different. I mean, I think you can't compare one owner to the next because all of their revenue streams are different in baseball because they have the Yes Network in New York makes a whole lot more money than Fox Sports Kansas City as far as what the Royals get versus what the Yankees get. It's not like they put all the money in a pot and divide it by, what is it, 30 in baseball? Yep. You know, and then some players in baseball are making hundreds of thousands, and others are making tens of millions. So, I mean, I don't think you can say collectively for any of them, because there's, much like society in baseball, there are princes and there are paupers. I mean, and I know that the paupers up there are far better off than any of us. But, I mean, the variation in pay for both owners and players is a pretty wide scale.
So I'm just wondering, like, when we talk about leverage, who would actually have more leverage? Because there has been lockouts before, not only in the NBA, but the MLB and others. Like, when you get into these conversations, like, I'm wondering, you mentioned who would benefit more or not benefit, who would be worse off if they didn't have a season?
Well,
because the other party would have more leverage to be able to say that.
If history's an indicator, the owners caved to the players in baseball years ago. And that's how we got to the point with the guaranteed contracts and the things that baseball players get to enjoy that NFL players don't have. And the history in the NFL, which we're nowhere near anything of this nature, the history of the NFL is the owners have had the upper hand.
JT in Hot Springs texted in and said, "I'm sorry, Todd, but I wouldn't give you your full paycheck for half the work." JT, you weren't listening. They were already getting their contracts prorated, so like that's not what I said. You got to listen, man.
Well, they've been prorated for the games they haven't played. They want full pay for the games they are going to play, even with no
no fans. Yeah,
with no fans. I mean, there's got to be you can't expect the owners to go into their pocket to play games. Not that deep.
They're just in a situation where, again, the players feel like, regardless if you believe that or not, they don't want to get leveraged in a situation where they're losing even more money, because like they also are losing, now not to the extent of the owners, because the owners have to cover everything, but they're still losing a lot of money, and the more games that they don't play and everything going on, the owners and players are both taking massive hits. That's what they're having to do
now. But the owners are the ones that are on the banknotes. The owners are the ones that are responsible to people beyond just the individual. So, I mean, both sides have a lot to lose here. But there's a lot more obligations and a lot more liabilities with owning versus playing.
Is it just me, or does it seem like you don't ever hear about these problems with, like, NFL and NBA? It seems like... there's problems. I'm not saying there's not.
Well, but. I mean, first of all, we're talking about trying to resume play with Major League Baseball. The NBA... I mean, they haven't been as public about it, but those players got paychecks through April, and they're not getting paid for May, if I remember right, for the NBA.
I think you're correct.
And then you've got some superstar players, like LeBron, whose contract calls for their salaries to be paid like half of the... They're all broken up and done a little bit different. But the superstars in the NBA, let's just say he was going to make $20 million this year. I don't know what his number is. It's probably a lot bigger than that. He would get $10 million at the start of the season, and then it was on a schedule throughout the rest of the season. Well, that means he's going to have to pay that money back. He's going to have to write a check or take credit towards future earnings for some of these players. Some of them get paid monthly. They're all paid generally a little different. And that's another rub with some of them right now. They're going to have to cut a check back for games they haven't and are not going to play.
Because there's like a clause in these contracts that if something like this was to happen, which no one in a million years thought it would, that, as you mentioned, they don't get paid for certain games or whatever the case may be.
And I think you will see all of the contracts in Major League Sports adapt and change to fit this kind of situation.
Because it was, I mean, again, even though it was in the contracts and stuff, I don't think anyone ever anticipated something like this happen, but now it has happened with sports, and it's definitely impacted it. So it begs the question again, when we started the conversation, what would it be like in college football stadiums, in NFL stadiums, if there weren't fans? Joe Buck on HBO Real Sports commented on that. Here's what he had to say.
Going into this season coming up, and that comes with a huge asterisk, I think Fox and these networks have to put crowd noise under us. In fact, I know they'll do it. It's pretty much a done deal. I think whoever is going to be at that control is going to have to be really good at their job and be realistic with how a crowd would react depending on what just happened on the field. So it's really important. And then on top of that, they're looking at ways to put virtual fans in the stands. So when you see a wide shot, it looks like the stadium's jam-packed. And
I don't remember if it was Korean baseball, but someone, they had these like prop-up fake fans, these like cardboards. That
I think this is a mistake, and they're missing a real opportunity here. The opportunity is to listen into the sound you don't otherwise get to hear. The opportunity is not putting virtual fans in the stands and piping in fake noise. The opportunity is to mic up the second baseman. The opportunity is to mic up more of the participants and responsibly use those sounds. There's the opportunity. I think they're
responsibly
passing on.
Is where you're.
Well, I mean, they're not going to piss in the Cheerios of their own at their own breakfast table here. I'm making up a phrase, but the television partners are not going to try to embarrass the teams and players or give away something that's strategic.
They might not too intentionally, but you know,
they mic up Eric Musselman and other SEC basketball coaches all the time. How many times has something embarrassing actually got on the air? I'd say the answer is zero. It's well looked at.
It's happened. Well, I'm just saying, like,
what major secret or embarrassing comment has ever been aired?
The coaches and players, for the most part, do they like being mic'd up? Most of the time, answer is no.
This is what you've got to do to help your sport survive.
I'm just telling you that. So when they're getting, and I don't know how like negotiations go as far as like the SEC network as far as goes, because that's not a bad idea. I think
that's the opportunity to tell part of the story and to give someone a reason to tune in. Is tell some of the story you don't otherwise get to tell.
So what? The XFL was able to do, what the AAF was able to do, where you got the like breaking stuff like that. You're wanting stuff like that,
yes. Innovation.
But coaches and players, for the most part, didn't like that. So,
well, I mean, there's a lot of things about my job I don't like, but you got to do them to survive. So, I mean, I'm just saying we're in uncertain times, unusual times, all the catchphrases. You got to do unusual things.
So
right
do you
now.
Give them like more money for doing?
No,
like,
you just do it because why do you, that's what you got to do to survive right now.
Do you think those type of things people tune in more because of those things?
I think it adds to the production value of a television broadcast, and I think it gives you something as a broadcaster. If I'm Joe Buck in the booth, it gives me something else, some other gadget to focus on, some other side story to tell. When the fans, which how many times at a broadcast do they cut to a fan reaction? It's hundreds of times throughout nine innings or a football game where they cut to someone, the stands who's got their hands over their face or someone cheering for joy or whatever. The fan reaction is a big part of the television broadcast you may not even think about. So what do you replace that with? You got to replace it with something. Maybe another opportunity is you zoom in. Select fans. You have some kind of sweepstakes or contest or some ability to identify super fans for the Cardinals and the Braves. Let's just say they're televising that game. And we're going to cut to them after a big hit or a home run in their living room. I don't know. You're going to have to be innovative and creative to come up with ways to make these broadcasts. You'll never make them feel real and normal, but to at least add some of these elements that have become part of what the director's sitting there switching between, you know, the camera focused on the guy rounding third and then immediately switching to the person in the stands cheering or in agony. You know, that's part of telling the story.
JT in Hot Springs texting. He says, if they allow us to hear what it's said on the field, you better delay in a great dump button person. Yeah. So that's a good point because, yeah, words said on the field typically
you
do that.
You don't have to do it live either, you know.
Chris and Harrison text in, those empty stands are also prime ground for signage, whether physical or digital overlay.
Remember how they used to tarp sections of baseball parks? They bring in the big tarps and put a logo on them. That's exactly what you're going to see more of.
Yeah, I guess see more logos and stuff.
Right.
So, when I'm disagreeing you, I'm just telling you there's going to be, and again, I would think that'd be cool. I think that's a great idea. I'm just telling you there's going to be pushback from players, coaches, owners, whoever, for doing that. And if it actually goes through or if it doesn't go through, that's going to be the reason not. Not that I don't want to see it, because, again, I'd like to see it. I think that adds an element to the game, exactly what you're talking about. I don't know how impactful it would be compared to, because people are just going to watch college football regardless of, it's just they're going to watch it. Now, it would add an element, I think, that many people enjoyed with the XFL, and I think if you're going to do that, you might as well mic the refs too.
Sure.
And so you'd be okay with that.
Sure.
Because you've been against it in the past when I've asked you about that.
Miking the refs?
Yeah.
When have I been against that?
I've asked, like, for transparency and stuff. You said...
No, I've been very... I mean, like what the XFL or whichever, where they had the insight into the replay booths. I'm for that stuff. I don't know where you'd think I'm against it.
Because we've had this conversation before, and you didn't.
I don't know that you need, again, responsible airing. I'm not saying you just pot something up and we're going to listen to a private conversation. That's not what happens now with, like, all access on the SEC network. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about putting responsible, selection. I don't know what editing is the right word. I don't know if you want to edit someone's conversations, but, you know, being responsible about what actually makes air. I'm not saying have live mics on players, and as the play-by-play is going on, we do that. What makes, like NASCAR, that was back live. What makes NASCAR, and what did Fox Sports do to, I think, really advance the television production quality of the sport? They included more sound. They put cameras in places no one had done before, and then the cars come by, and you hear all these sounds and these noises, and you go into the pits, and you're listening to the headset conversations. Those aren't live when they're listening to the headsets in NASCAR. I think one of the interesting things to do would be listening to headset conversations with football coaches. I don't think it will ever go that far, but it'd be another reason to tune in.
So you think you wouldn't want it be piped up live at any point. You're just rather for edited conversations as far as the mics up with the refs, as far as the mics up with the coaches, the players and stuff. You don't want it full.
Well, because I think you're going to find most of it's not interesting. I know everybody's got this idea that you bring up referees, that they're having these conspiracy conversations about how to screw your team, but they're probably talking about where they're going to go to dinner and have a cold beer after the game, or if the ice is melting in the cooler out in the suburban.
I hope they're not doing that in the middle of the job.
There's probably.
I hope they're not.
Well, you
doing
talk
that
about drinking cold beer all the time on the job. So what's the difference? You know.
Well,
so
I'm a radio
I don't think we're going to find that these conversations are interesting. I think what we'd find interesting is maybe some good saucy trash talk that could be aired between a first baseman and a guy that just got on. Maybe that's interesting. Or a guy slides in for a steal, and he went a little hard on the second baseman who's trying to turn the double play, and words were exchanged there. I think it's irresponsible for a broadcaster just to his own organization to try to air that stuff live without a significant delay. That's just hard to do and not worth the risk. But, again, I go back to the model of what the SEC does in miking up coaches. They don't run that stuff live, but you get some decent stuff out of a broadcast that they cut to throughout four or five times during a two-hour period.
When you think about that, and again, I think people keep saying you're right, and we're in the same camp, so everyone listening, I agree. I'm just like coaches and stuff. You think about Spygate, you think about everything, like the different scandals and stuff, and the Astros and everything involved there. When you have stuff like this, coaches, you know how coaches are paranoid. Now, players,
always.
Players
come out of the womb paranoid.
Players aren't as paranoid, Tommy, but coaches are. So when there's more videotaping, when there's more anything involved like that, they're going to be skeptical, regardless if it advances, if the elements, because again, I agree with you 100%. It adds an element to the game that you need, but the coaches are going to be freaking out with this type of stuff because they always think they're being recorded. They always think the opposing coach is trying to do whatever they can, put a leg up on them to cheat. And so this is only going to add to their paranoia, and you're going to see some significant pushback from them when it comes to this conversation.
But that's so much better than what Joe Buck's talking about here and piping in fake crowd noise and computer imaging fans into the stands. Man, I'm not... If it's fake,
it's fake.
Send
a letter to Fox then.
Well, I mean, they don't need my help. I mean, they're a lot smarter than me. I'm just not... That doesn't excite me. I don't want something fake added. Add something that's real. That's all I'm suggesting here is... Those conversations, that trash talking, that interaction between a referee and a coach, that interaction where whatever it is real. So let's make that part of the broadcast.
I think it was the Falcons that got in trouble a little while back for piping in fake crowd noise. So we'll see if that ends up happening.
Musk's social media stuff is absolutely hilarious.
Put a sub in! We need some depth!
Oh, my
God! Call a timeout! You're on a 2-0 run! You're on a TO!
I know why we're down at the first media timeout.
That is priceless.
Oh, my God.
That's unbelievable.
You know what's funny, Coach Greenberg, is when you've been fired enough, then you just don't really care. And you do silly stuff like that.
Welcome back into the Morning Rush. Our next guest, ESPN college basketball analyst and former Virginia Tech coach, Seth Greenberg, now joins us. Coach, good morning. Thanks for your time. You had a chance to catch up with Coach Muss last week, talk some hoops. What's that been like, just talking everything remotely with everything going on with COVID-19 right now?
It was terrific. I mean, let's face it, we are all so fortunate for the doctors, the nurses, the hospital workers, the people that are moving the food chain, the EMTs, people that are working to keep stores alive and keep our lives some semblance of normal. But just to be able to get away and share experiences, I mean, you know, there's nothing better than talking ball. And, you know, you're talking about a bunch of basketball junkies. And just to get lost in that moment for an hour, tell stories, have opinions, have a conversation, you know, it was great. And four different conversations in itself. Scotty, obviously, from prism of an NBA coach. Moss, obviously, has coached at every level. And then any league that ended with an association he's coached in, and then obviously Shaka, and what's going on in Texas. So we had a great time, and I appreciate those guys giving me some time to do the web show, and it was a blast, man. It was a blast.
Coach, how has your perspective changed moving to the media side of things at ESPN? Have you changed your mindset when it comes to in-game stuff at all, or do you pretty much think the same way when it comes to college basketball?
First of all, you know, I don't look at myself as a journalist. You guys are journalists. I'm just a fired basketball coach talking ball. the prism I look at the game through and the preparation I do is no different than when I was coaching. So if I'm going to be in the studio on Big Monday and have, you know, a Big Ten game and an ACC game, I'm going to watch those teams two or three times. I'm going to watch their league in preparation so that I really have an understanding of who they are, how they win, what's important to them. And that's what I do all day. I do it all summer so that I can just talk ball. But my approach is the same. In terms of how I would coach, if I went back to coaching, I'd probably play with a little bit more flow for sure. I would stick to being more multiple defensively. I always played with two point guards. It's funny, everyone's trying to play with two, but I used to call them ball guards. And that's like a phenomenon. I played positionless basketball. We played a small forward at the power forward forever because those are the guys I could get and win with. So I just didn't call it small ball or, you know, positionless basketball. I said, like, hey, I want two point guards because we're not going to turn it over. I want two small forwards that have some size because I want to create a matchup problem, be able to switch, and I want a big guy that can play off penetration. And all of a sudden, that's become small ball, and everyone's got a nickname for it. So I would change some, but not drastically. Hey, the whole key is getting guys that are committed to playing hard, trusting each other, believing in the good of the group, and being competitive.
How far back do you and Coach Musselman go? You mentioned before we started the interview that y'all were good friends. Where did you first encounter Eric Musselman?
I've known Muss forever. Actually, I knew his dad before I knew Muss. I went to one of his dad's clinics when I was an assistant at the University of Pittsburgh. But a dear friend of his was my student body vice president when I was at South Florida, a guy named Dave Mintzberg, who is a vice president of the Milwaukee Bucks right now. And he's really close with Muss. And my brother was actually Muss's assistant coach for the Venezuelan national team way back. And that's how kind of we reconnected. And we've been pretty good friends probably for the last, I don't know, 10 years or so. And I'm on the bus. I love his passion. I love how much he cares. I love, he's a terrific coach. He'll grind on you a little bit. He is really, really embraced. Well, Danielle has embraced the social media aspect of it. He's having fun. He's having more fun coaching now than he's ever had. And I think now that he's found the joy in coaching and he's found his niche, and I got so much respect for him. And he's a terrific coach. He's a great person. He loves what he's doing. His family is totally immersed in Arkansas, as they were in, quite honestly, Nevada. And I think he's great for the game of college basketball.
Has he sparked the right balance between NBA experience and college experience? He seems to kind of be cornering that market, or maybe that's just because we cover him a little closer, but there doesn't seem to be too many college coaches that have the resume and the balance between pro ball and college ball, and I think he's found a way to exploit that to his advantage, Coach.
Well, he, you know, he has an NBA mindset. You know, it's really helped him offensively. I mean, just flow and spacing and things of that nature. But I think the biggest thing is, look, first of all, he's incredibly smart. He's very, very bright. He's got an insatiable appetite to work. He does a terrific job of finding players, and then, you know, like even this recruiting class with the two transfers and the four freshmen. He uses his NBA pedigree to his advantage in recruiting, which is important. And if they can start putting some guys in the league, that'll continue to enhance it with the Martin twins playing right now from Nevada. And he's got an energy about him. So he's likable, and he can really coach. So yeah, finding that balance has been important. But I think he found that balance, and I'm going to say it again, and I joke with him, but you know, Danielle's given him great balance because Musk never had that balance. Maybe when he was an NBA coach, I think they are great. They're as good a team, a husband wife team, as there is in college basketball.
Talking with Seth Greenberg, college basketball analyst for ESPN here on The Morning Rush. Coach, you bring up Mrs. Danielle. We were talking about her pretty extensively last week heading up to Mother's Day weekend. I don't know many coaches' wives outside of like Terry Saban that are as well known as Danielle Musselman. And you think about the strengths she brings to the table as a former broadcaster. Do you think she gets enough credit for everything she does for the Arkansas basketball program?
Well, I think she gets credit from us for sure. I mean, look, her background in media has been invaluable. Look, she's very comfortable in front of people. She's very comfortable getting behind causes. She's very comfortable in any environment. You can put her in any environment, she's just going to fit in. She's always got that big smile on her face, and she's very welcoming, and she wants to make a difference. And they're a great team. I mean, they're a great team. I think they sat down and said, like, all right, what can we do to make us different? And, you know, the crazy ideas they do on social media are great. But, you know, it's more than that. You know, like, a coach's wife is so valuable. They've got to care as much about the program and the players and the process and the head coach's, you know, his well-being in terms of wins and losses and the responsibility. It really is a tremendous responsibility. And there are a lot of, you know, tremendous coaches' wives. I mean, all coaches' wives, quite honestly, are tremendous, in my opinion. But Danielle's great, and she's embraced it. And, you know, Eric and Danielle together are just, they're phenomenal. They're great people. I mean, they just, you know, like I said, just I think the world of their family and what they're doing.
Coach, you speak of media. You're on the college basketball, college game day crew. You, LaFonso Ellis, Reese Davis, and Jay Billis. Would you think that you guys are going to wind up in Fayetteville based on what Mus has coming in this next season?
It's real simple. Win games. You know, I mean, it has nothing to do with who's coming in. It's how those dudes play. I mean, win games and have a weekend that isn't Duke, Carolina. Against a good opponent that could do a rating. Like, you know, I could see a Kentucky Arkansas game at Arkansas. I was at Virginia Tech. We hosted College Game Day. We beat Duke when they were number one in the country. And you know why we got that? We were good. We won games. And that was before it was, you know, where there are options. I mean, that was week to week. But we won games, and we were playing Duke. It was going to do a good number. Because in the end, we got to do a good number. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the responsibility with it. But, yeah, I mean, look, there are really good things happening. You know, look, the ownership that they've created, the atmosphere they've created, you know, quite honestly, Eric has a likability to him. You know, they're a good story. And if they're a good team and the dates align, I mean, we're all for, like, we went to Baylor this year. It was great. I mean, I love going to new places. Because when you go to new places, people appreciate it.
Yeah. You bring up Virginia Tech. Is the fire still within you? Is that fire moved on to television now? Or do you still have the desire to coach again someday?
Look, I turned on the job this past year. And it was the ideal right situation. I would do it. I work with the greatest people in the world. I have one of the great jobs of all time because of the people I work with. And what, you know, I don't take for granted one day the opportunity that ESPN's given me. It's been 8 years, which is incredible. I've got a bunch of years left on a contract. You know, I'm very, very fortunate for the opportunity. I have fun with it. I work with incredible people, whether it's, you know, Jay and Fonz and Reese or Kevin Connors or you know, our people behind the scenes, you know, whether it's, you know, Rob Lemley or Steve Oling or any of the producers and directors, you know, Jeff Brown, who produces Game Day. I mean, I'm just really fortunate. So it would have to be an ideal situation. The situation this year was, you know, was pretty close to that. But then with the virus and everything, I just didn't think the timing was right. So you never say never because you don't want to be a hypocrite.
Yeah.
You know, you miss impacting someone's life. You miss doing that. But I also I love what I'm doing, and I'm working with really, really good people, and I'm having fun. But, you know, I just don't want to be hypocritical. Say, oh, no, I'll never do that. Then you turn around and you do it. People say, that guy's full of it.
I know when time came to an end at Virginia Tech, you had recruiting headed in the right direction. I was reading an article from some time ago that you had multiple future MBA recruits on campus when time came to a close. It seemed like you had everything headed in the right direction, and the momentum was going your way at Tech when it all ended.
Well, not only that, we had Montrezl Harrell signed already. And Montrezl was absolutely incredible. You know, who's now a great player for the Clippers and won a national championship. We started four freshmen my last year. We had great success. We were third winning program in the ACC over 5 years, and then I had one losing year, and I got whacked. You know, four of those years we didn't go to the tournament. I mean, we averaged over 10 wins a game in the ACC, played 16 games, beat Duke and Carolina 1 year, and didn't go to the tournament. So, you know, we won a lot of games. I took the job in the Big East, and they'd never been to the Big East tournament. We won 8 games the first year in the Big East, went to the tournament, won a game. We went to the ACC the next year. We were picked for last. We came in fourth. Beat Georgia Tech when they were fifth in the country, beat Duke when they were number one in the country. From that point on, the next 5 years were the five winningest years in the history of Virginia Tech. So I'm real proud of what we were able to accomplish. And, you know, but it didn't work. Fortunately, I got an opportunity to do this, and it's been absolutely incredible.
Coach, you guys went 25-9 in 2010. Now, you mentioned some of the years where you beat some of the premier teams in the ACC. Musk always talks about non-conference scheduling. Anthony Ruta is an assistant on his staff, and he talks about how important that is. When it comes to non-conference scheduling, how important do you think that is for college basketball today?
Well, I think it's more difficult because, you can say all you want about non-conference scheduling. You're playing 20 games in your league. You're playing in an exempt tournament. You're playing the SEC Big 12 Challenge. How many more freaking games do you got to schedule?
Yeah,
I mean, like, I get, well, who did they play non-conference? They played 20 games in the SEC. They played an SEC Big 12 game. They played an exempt tournament. Right? Right there, that's 25 games against good teams. How many more games do you need to, you know, I mean, like, people just don't realize it. I mean, so, you know, it's you got to find a balance. Yeah. You got to play a good schedule. You got to get games that are going to be significant on TV. But you can't have unless you're like Kentucky or someone like that. You can't have a whole schedule of them. And when you're playing in like the SEC, is top to bottom is really good. So when you're playing in a league like that, you've got to, you know, you got to find a balance. But you got to be a good team. You got to get home and homes. Yeah.
Coach,
Virginia Tech was a hard place because no one wanted to play us because we were good. Yeah. And we didn't sound good enough to get loose to.
With a pathway now being opened with the G League and the NBA finding a way for best high school recruits and those handful of elite blue chippers to enter into their league, into their development, make money right away, how big a danger is this for college basketball to take the four or five best prospects a year for college basketball and perhaps they choose to go to the G League? Is this something college basketball really needs to be concerned of and find a way to get ahead of?
We've all got to come to the table and do what's best for interest of the kids. I'm not sure that's happening right now. So, three or four guys is not going to change college basketball. And the G League Academy, we're going to find out. Unfortunately, you're going to see a lot of kids try to get into the G League Academy, and they're going to have nowhere to go back to. They're going to get exposed. So seven guys play a lot. What happened to the three guys that don't play a lot? Is that going to impact the draft status? Do they have the infrastructure to do that? The thing that bothers me about the, and Sam Mitchell's a dear friend of mine, but the thing that really bothers me or irritates me about the whole G League thing is they're actually recruiting guys right off college campuses, off kids' teams. That's number one, so that are committed. Number two is, do they have the infrastructure? And I am so tired of listening to people say, well, you know, these kids say, well, I got to learn the NBA game. Like, the last time I checked, college guys teach you how to get better, teach you how to compete, teach you how to understand the game, be a teammate, mature, develop in more ways than just basketball. But when it comes to basketball, last time I checked, John Calipari guys are pretty ready to play in the NBA, and Bill Self's guys are pretty ready to play in the NBA. Jay Wright's guys are pretty ready to play in the NBA. Don't tell me guys in college basketball are teaching guys how to be ready for the NBA. Here's the deal. The NBA is an exclusive club. It's an exclusive club. It's not for everyone. We talk about it like it's for everyone. It's for the very few. So, I mean, I think that I worry that a lot of lives are going to be impacted.
Coach Seth Greenberg with us here on the Morning Rush. Coach, before we let you go, we like to talk food on this program. We're in the South. The best pizza for my money is Gino's East in Chicago. What is Seth Greenberg's best pizza that he's ever had?
Oh, I don't know. Any pizza is good to me. Old way back in the day when I was an assistant at Columbia, Ray's was really good. In New York City, it was thin and it was crispy and it was cheesy and it was greasy. I mean, I'm a New York City pizza guy. I'm a thin crust. I mean, Chicago's great. That Chicago pizza's great, but that thin crusted New York crispy pizza, man, you can't beat it.
Coach, I know there's like 1,000 Johns in New York, but the only time I've actually been to New York City was when I was 7 years old. We went to Johns. I don't know if it was on 4. I have no idea where it was, but I can. I'll give you credit. New York pizza, it's pretty stinking good. Seth Greenberg on Twitter at Seth on Hoops, college basketball analyst for ESPN. Coach, we really appreciate you making some time for us this morning.
My pleasure, guys. Be safe.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a premium light lager brewed with real lemonade.
He does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number 3, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown, Hogs! Holy Hog!
Andy Mountainhome wants to get on the conversation. He texted, watching Chad Morris completely implode and seek the Auburn program was one of the things I'm most looking forward to. And I don't know if you differ on if he's going to have success immediately, eventually, or not at all, but it's going to be very curious to watch. And I'm very curious to see if Bo Nix progresses or if he implodes like Andy's under the impression of. Because, I mean, you saw some glimpses of his potential talent at Auburn last year. Now it's gonna be curious to see, hey, can he take that next step under Chad Morris as a quarterback?
We do know the most Arkansas thing ever is he's going to go down there and win the division this year, right? That's like kind of what I'm expecting is them and Alabama play the Iron Bowl for the division championship.
That's
the most Arkansas thing ever.
I'm under the impression he's going to have success. Now, I don't know if it's going to be right away, but something tells me he's going to be much better in a coordinator role rather than a head coach.
Well, he was before.
Maybe he's not fit for the SEC, but I just think he's going to have – and again, it might not be right away, and this is just me assuming at this point. You know what they say about assuming, but that's what I'm thinking. Clay, what are your thoughts on that, man?
And you have to look at more than just the coordinator. What happened at Auburn in the off season is really interesting in that J.B. Grimes, who's an Arkansas guy, decided to retire. Now, he may coach again, but he's in retirement, and I think he's on Lake De Grey right now. So he's in Arkansas. That's his retirement home that he'd built previously. And he walked away. They hired Jack Bicknell. He'd been in the NFL, was at Ole Miss the last couple of years. But they lost their complete offensive line. They had they started 5 seniors last year. Now, they might have played some guys, you know, in backup roles that got on the field. But they lost 5 seniors in the offensive line. Now, they've got good players at Auburn. but they lost a lot of good defensive linemen. I think Marlon Davidson, Derrick Brown. Yep, the defensive tackle.
Yeah, they lost some really talented players.
Yeah, they were wiped out. You know, what I noticed about Auburn's team last year at Arkansas was the line play. And we'll just see that, you know, everybody focuses on calling plays, coordinator, but it's in the critical issue last year at Arkansas was the offensive line. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter what plays you called. And the quarterbacks, no matter which one played, they were running for their lives. And we'll see what happens with the offensive line. New offensive line coach, new coordinator, didn't have spring practice. That's when you get your line set. So when you talk about what's going to happen at Auburn, I'm not sure we know. And I'm not sure we can predict what influence that Chad's going to have right off the bat. And the thing that you know is that he understands what they're doing because his offense and his mindset is similar to Gus. He got it from Gus. That his offense, all the principles are Malzahn, how they read the safeties, how they, but anybody that thinks Gus is just going to walk away from the offense is wrong. He's not going to do that. He's never going to do that. And so I think we'll have a hard time figuring out exactly what Chad's doing with this offense because I think Gus is going to have his hand right in there.
Yeah, I think he's going to be a part of it. And, Clay, you mentioned I knew they had lost a decent amount of the offensive line, but you said, was it all five starters?
All five starters. Okay. All five were seniors. The week, because this is what I wrote about the week. You know, I like to do the keys to victory, and I got into in the line play and really focused on both their defensive line and their offensive line in that game. And they weren't great in the offensive line, but they were all seniors. And it's
we'll find out how well they've recruited then. So.
That, no question. Yeah. But you're also talking about how well a new offensive line coach meshes with some inexperienced players. Now, he's a highly experienced coach. He's head coach for 8 years at Louisiana Tech. He coached in the NFL, the Chiefs, the Dolphins, and then now there were a lot of times he was only someplace 1 year, so you wonder what kind of coach he is. And their offensive line wasn't really great at Ole Miss. That's everybody said that the worst offensive lines in the SEC, the West, the last couple of years have been Arkansas and Ole Miss. So he's going to be under the gun to sort it out. I'm talking about Vic Nell. And I think Chad and Gus will get along better than maybe some of the offensive coordinators with Gus in the past, just because they've always been close. I mean, their wives are close. I mean, that's going to be a nice mesh, and I think that's why their fans are talking about that. But I'll point to the offensive line. That will determine if their offense is successful.
So, Clay, in the past, Kenny Dillingham, who's been there, Rhett Lashley, I'm trying to think of the other coordinators. Who else?
Chip Lindsey,
yeah, that was the other one. So, I mean, he's had relationships with these guys, and I know Lashley played quarterback for him at Shiloh, if I remember that correctly. So,
it comes down to quarterback play, and they've got an experienced quarterback coming back that's run this offense. So, when they have struggled, it didn't really matter who that coordinator was. It matters who the quarterback is.
Mm-hmm.
And that offense revolves around so many decisions post-snap by the quarterback. You know, it's the reads. It's all those option plays require the quarterback seeing an end, seeing a tackle, seeing a line, whatever the read is on the play, and that's why the experience is so important. Knicks got better as the year went on. I mean, you have to admit that. But it's, will that offensive line protect him and enable him to pass a little bit? Because you can't just run it in the SEC. It's not – that ain't going to happen.
Yeah, and he was, again, we got to remind people, he was a true freshman last year, so he did progress. I think he was given a little too much credit for the Alabama victory when it was more the offensive line and the running game. That and the luck that they always seem to every once
and their defense
through. Yeah and their defense yeah. that showed up when they
and we'll see with some of those, I call them horses, you know, those defensive line guys, they still got good players, but I'm not sure Davidson and Brown were great players. They weren't just good players.
Yeah, you remember the conversation, I've talked to Tommy about this, Clay, where Ed Orgeron is walking off the field and he puts his arm around both those guys. It's like, this is why I recruited you. You guys are going to be first round draft picks. And I know Brown was drafted, I think you said fifth overall, and I think
somewhere in there. I mean, he was a high choice. So.
And I think Davidson was also drafted either in the first round or second round. So Ed Orgeron was
two great players.
Yeah, and just absolutely. I mean, you can have those guys on the D line, but as you mentioned, with the offensive line being depleted and the five starters gone because they were all seniors, I'm wondering. And it seems like Gus is on the hot seat every year. Could we see a situation, Clay, that Chad Morris is on the hot seat after just 1 year?
Yeah, you can.
So, I mean, with the Auburn fans, we joke often how Auburn has the craziest fans in the SEC, and the SEC is an ever-revolving door when it comes to coordinators because of the pressure. I think it's one of those things, regardless of if the offense – I mean, I think the expectations are going to be high as they always are at Auburn, Alabama.
Well, yeah, you're right. They will in Auburn, in Alabama. I mean, it's a zoo with, you know, the pressure and the expectations that they have because they've had success, both programs.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about in the last 15 years. There's been enough success that they expected and demanded. And they look at the other one. When the other one is having success, it puts even more pressure on you. But because they beat Alabama last year, and I'll also say the reality is next year is going to be a wash. There's not going to be anybody that pins any coach down for the struggles when you may be playing nine games. You're not going to have any spring practice. All the regulations, health-wise, and things that they're going to do that just make it almost impossible to have a routine. It's going to be an unbelievable year. And so I think that there's going to be, quote, some passes given because of, well, you know, how can you hold a coach on what their team looks like when they haven't had any practices?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. In case you're
I'm not talking about Sam Pittman. I'm talking about everybody
across the board.
And LSU has replaced all of their players. I mean, they lost basically first team offense, first team defense. They did. And then they lost their passing game coordinator and their defensive coordinator, and they didn't have spring practice. I don't know what you expect from them, although they have great players. It's going to be an unusual year.
And Miles Brennan is a pretty highly heralded quarterback, but he's, again, having to follow in the footsteps of one of the greatest single-season QBs ever in Joe Burrow. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see what happens down the bayou this year. In case you're just hopping on, we're talking about Chad Morris, if he's going to have success at Auburn. Some Auburn fans are under the impression that he is the steal of the offseason. Jake in Magazine texts in, he says, I think he will be successful as a coordinator again. Some guys just aren't cut out to be a college head coach, and definitely not in the SEC West. Matt in Dallas texts in, he says, don't want to wish the guy bad luck. I think he'll change his ways under Gus's leadership, and we'll see if his system works in the SEC.
Yeah, so are we about to hit a break, or do I have a minute or two?
You got more than a few.
Okay, so here's what I see about Chad Morris. When you say, is he cut out to be a coordinator? I think he found out once he got to SMU and after a year or so that his ability to have a direct hand on all the play calling, everything about the offense like he had at Clemson is gone. And then when he got to Arkansas, I mean, it's because of the time that it takes to be a head coach. Then you got to Arkansas, and you put it in a whole different circumstance, speaking at 15 Razorback clubs every spring. The pressure of recruiting the SEC that a head coach has to spend on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then just the day-to-day operation of the media, you know, all the things that you did at Arkansas that you didn't even have to think about at SMU, I think it took away all of his input on the offense. So the offense that you saw at Arkansas that you think, well, that didn't look like a Chad Morris offense, that's because it wasn't. But I think he will have the time because they wipe all of those media duties away at Auburn. I don't think he'll have hardly any thing but just straight coaching, and his recruiting will be cut by he'll probably have to do about 10% of the time on recruiting that he did as a head coach at Arkansas. Just what he was trying to do, rebuild talent wise, he spent so much time on recruiting, so much time on media, so much time, you know, it just, I think the day-to-day operation of running an offense, he couldn't do at Arkansas. Mm-hmm.
So, Tommy, let me ask you this. If he does have success, will there be any seller's remorse from Arkansas fans seeing this? Because I would think not, but none. I think you don't think a single Arkansas fan
as,
would
as a head coach? No. I think we all saw enough in those embarrassing losses that, you know, it was time as to cut ties there.
As they say, that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
Ship has sailed.
I mean, for him, his success is going to – I mean, because Gus needs something good to happen there because, as we talked about earlier, Gus is never more than two losses away from the hot seat at Auburn. So Gus is putting a lot of faith in his coordinator, whether it's Chad Morris or anybody else. They've got to be successful because it seems like Gus is perennially fighting to win a game or two to save his job.
Yeah.
That just seems to constantly be the storyline, fairly or unfairly. If he doesn't win at least 10, they want him. There's a big faction, that fan base, that wants to make a change. And the reality is eventually they're going to get him. Eventually he won't survive.
Tommy, it won't matter who the coach is at Auburn. That's the reality of what that is, as long as Nick Saban is rolling at Alabama. Because that's the comparison. I mean, that's what they live with. That's what they see on TV 24/7. I mean, the Montgomery TV stations, you know, the Birmingham station, they're covering Alabama.
Right.
And they're seeing, you know, it is the Nick Saban show in every media outlet, and it just infuriates the Auburn people. We can't stand it, and it's a different situation than any place else in the country.
I would just say it's been amplified, though, since he was given that huge raise when he didn't go to Arkansas, and whatever happened there, I just think it's been amplified a bit more just because of what happened
doubt.
3 years
ago. Yeah, and I think it was Danny Ford that told me, and this was in 93, I think, and we were just doing a one-on-one, and we were talking about the SEC. Or maybe he was just an interim coach. Maybe he was working for Kynes. But we had the first one-on-one that I did with him. I was like, just tell me about the SEC. And he says, you're a two-game losing streak from being in hot water. He said, that's what the SEC is. He said, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, it's Georgia, it's Florida, it's Tennessee, you know, all these, you know, these heavyweight SEC programs, Alabama, Auburn, LSU, you lose two in a row, they're tired of you. And it is intense pressure. You know, I'd like to get it on a two-game winning streak. How about that, Tommy?
Yeah. What's that feel like? It's been so long.
I don't know. So, yeah. I do not know. It's sometime in my lifetime, but it's a long time ago.
Y'all think about Auburn's schedule ahead. They play North Carolina and Atlanta. They play at Alabama. They play at Georgia, which are probably going to be the two best teams in the Southeastern Conference this fall. So Gus Malzahn and Chad Morris played on top of the offensive lineman that you talked about they lost. Their running back, Booby Willow, if I remember correctly, I don't remember where he ended up, but I think he ended up in the transfer portal. So they're one of their best players as far as offense. He's, I don't think, no longer with the program. So I just did a double negative, Clay. Sorry.
Well, they've recruited well the last few years. They've got good players.
Yeah.
And I can't sit here and go through the names. I've got their website up. I could probably pull it up and tell you some of them. But they have had good recruiting, mm-hmm. and they've recruited good running backs. And that's and I think they've got some good ones coming in this current class.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just going to be a crazy year. We cannot speculate on what anything's going to be like right now. We just don't know. Do you realize? So I'm sitting here trying to think about doing a college football preview, the Arkansas football preview, which we do this time of year every year. I got no depth chart. There's no way to make a depth chart.
Yeah.
There's no way to get the coaches to give you a depth chart. They don't know. And that's the way it is almost everywhere. They can't give you a depth chart at LSU. They didn't have practice.
You can't even print a schedule realistically.
No, you really can't. In fact, I was just thinking the other day, I think sometime this weekend, what Arkansas schedule, say Notre Dame falls off, they don't go, they decide that they're not going to go to Notre Dame. I'm just speculating that this has not happened. But that's a possibility. In fact, I think Pat Forty, SI.com, has already said, that Notre Dame thinks that Arkansas may not come. That's one of their athletic directors is said in meetings that he's not sure that game will be played.
Because he's already
– they. Yeah.
He's already come out and said that they won't have a full stadium.
Yeah.
We talked about that on
Friday.
They won't
have a full stadium. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No question.
It's pretty clear they're scared.
So,
Yeah. Pretty clear.
They don't want the smoke, Clay.
Pretty clear they don't want any part of Arkansas.
They've decided that Sam Pittman's offensive line will blow them away.
Yep.
That's
pretty clear. Notre Dame wants nothing to do with Arkansas.
But just think about this, if for an Arkansas schedule, if they play one non-conference game like Nevada comes in. I don't even know if that's the one. But then they played eight conference games. They would have only two. So this is the year that Texas A&M would be a road game, right? I mean, it's technically. So you've got four true home games. You're playing at Arrowhead. You're playing at Arlington. So you're playing your true road games are what?
Neutral sites.
No. I mean those are neutral sites.
Right.
But, I mean, you got two true road games. You're playing, at Auburn, and you're playing at Mississippi State.
Right.
That's the only ones they'll have.
Yeah, and I could even, real quick here, I could even see a scenario you end up playing a Missouri or an A&M or someone twice this year on your schedule.
Good.
If the SEC teams are willing to play 8, 9, 10 ball games – guys, I could certainly see that coming to fruition this year where, all right, we're going to play 10, and we're just going to play all SEC schools this year. And maybe one or both are a conference game. Who knows? It's just going to be a weird year.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Bud Light Seltzer, 5% ABV and only 100 calories. We'd put it up against any other seltzer out there.